Hello and welcome to Mimi UU. I'm Mimi Nicklin, the host of the show. This podcast is anonymous and it's audio only, without names, to protect from unconscious bias or judgment and to allow true empathy to grow. The goal of the show is to share diverse stories from around the world by giving people a platform to share openly so that other people, like you, can understand diverse realities from around the globe. We exist to create empathy and not just talk about it. Welcome to Mimi UU.
Hello and welcome back to Mimi UU. Today's story is going to allow you to step into the shoes of a woman with seemingly unending tenacity, passion, and commitment for changing the lives of women and children in the part of the world that she's from. Living in an area which is constantly impacted and negatively affected by militant and terrorist organizational behavior, she has grown up in a world where over 50,000 people have had their lives taken and more than 2.5 million have been displaced. In a country and a region where girls' lives matter less than those of their male counterparts, where women are married off young, or I should say girls, are married off young, she shares her inspiration and how the women around her are fighting for change and finding their inspiration and their opportunity to dream, as she puts it, her dare to dream of a better and brighter future for women, for girls, for all of us. Before I kick off and introduce our guest today, I do just want to set up front that this is an anonymous show and that we won't reveal your identity or your location unless you choose to do so. Is that okay with you today?
Yes, please.
Wonderful. So thank you very much for joining me on Mimi UU to share your story. I would love to start by asking you, why did you say yes? When we reached out to ask you to join our show, why did you say yes to coming today? What was it about it that made you want to join us?
Oh, thank you very much for this opportunity. I said yes because, you know, over the years, over time, I have found that no one can tell my story better than I. And my story is my superpower, my voice. You know, being able to voice my story, that's power. So, and you never can tell who hears your story, you know, how wide it can go. And somehow, one or two persons can be touched. So, yes, I said that so that someone could hear and be inspired. Yeah, I think that's just simply why I said yes. You never can tell who you are influencing. You never can tell who will empathize with your story and somehow make a change or be encouraged to do something. You know, that's just why I said yes.
I love that. And thank you. Thank you for starting with that. I just resonate so much with your point there around my voice is my superpower. My story is my superpower. And you perfectly set up why I do this show every single week to meet people like you that believe in that. So thank you. Tell us a little bit. Where does your story begin?
Oh, well, it begins with my brother. He's dead now. He inspired me. His birth came from the part of the world where I'm from. There is still this wrong assumption that boys are better than girls in many ways. You know, having a male child as your first child somehow consolidates your marriage, and it ensures that someone will carry on your name and all of that. So, yes, he was the first child of the family. My parents were just two people who wanted to make each other happy. And so they decided to get married. They didn't know so much. There wasn't so much information about the way we have it today. And so they got married, and 9 months later, their marriage was blessed with a baby boy. Everyone was happy. They rejoiced. You know, having the first child as a male child was great. But unfortunately, a few months into the marriage, the baby was always sick and had to always be taken to the hospital. And that was when they found out that he was a sickle cell patient. He had the SS genotype. My parents didn't know anything about, you know, genotypes. They knew, but they didn't know the implications of being carriers of the sickle cell disease. And so it dawned on them that their child was sick. They were told they had to manage it. It was something that couldn't be changed. And so their lives now became centered around caring for this boy. He wasn't the average guy. He was nice, but he wasn't just nice. I think he had extra to him. He was a guide. He was somebody who could lead me, and I would just follow. I trusted him so much, and I learned a lot of things from him. One of the things that, you know, characterized his life was that he had so much knowledge. He was a straight A student, even though many times he was in the hospital, he had to miss school. But he was great with his work in school. And I think one of the things that gave him the edge, he had this desire, a very deep desire for knowledge. He wanted to know everything. He was that kind of guy who read everything. But, you know, his life was not the normal life in that sense that he was always sick. You know, sickle cell patients, some of the things they go through, they easily get fatigued and they are jaundiced. Most of the time they're in pains. Yeah, they have this swelling and pains frequently, especially in their joints, I think his hands, his legs. But despite all of the pains and, you know, the sicknesses, he was full of life. He loved life. He really did. And he wanted life to be better for everyone. He was a great leader. I also remember him organizing tournaments. He actually loved sports a lot. When you get into his room, you have to tiptoe around because on the floor of his room, he drew this football pitch, you know, because he was stopped from playing football. So he had this football pitch. He drew with chalk on the floor, and he used the bottle tops now. Yeah, bottle crowns as the players, and he uses his thumb. He taught one of my younger brothers to play. Sometimes he brings his friend, you know, home, and they play together. He was passionate about sports, so he organized tournaments for people in the streets, you know, street by street. And funny enough, he was still so young at that time. But he had this great organizing skills. He didn't have money, but he was good with his hands. I remember him making trophies for the tournaments he organized with his hands. You know, he'll put a lot of things together to just make trophies so that whoever wins, you know, goes home with the trophies. And many people didn't know how he came about that he made them. I remember him making cards for our birthdays with his hands. He made them. He made clocks. By himself, he made frames. He was good. Sometimes you would think he's an artist. And, you know, the next minute he's a singer. Another time he pretends to be a doctor. He knew about different ailments and all of that. He was a kind person. He was great with people, always smiling. He looks you into the eyes when he talks to you. And, you know, when he talks, people listen. They listen because he had this great knowledge and mental of fashion.
He sounds like a phenomenal, phenomenal person.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry he's no longer here with us. Tell me, how long did he live?
He lived for 19 years. But when he was 17, he gave his life to Christ. And that changed a lot of things because he had this major attack. I wasn't home then. I was away in boarding school. But I was told that that was the worst attack he ever had. And people thought he had, you know, we had lost him. But he came back And he decided that this was going to be the last of the attack. He collected all the syringes, the bottles of injections, you know, the drips. He said this was the last. He was going to keep it and, you know, one day show them to his children. And he decided he wasn't going to be on any drugs again. That was at the age of 17. And it worked for a time until he was 19. I think at this point, he now was like, okay, taking steps of what he was going to do, what he was going to be. He decided he was going to be a doctor. He actually worked towards it. He wrote exams and he was offered admission to Nottingham University. And it was in the process of working out the scholarship that he died. He had traveled to my hometown, to my home state, to process, because we didn't have the money for him to go abroad to study medicine. He didn't want children to suffer like he did. He didn't want, you know, sickle cell. He was like, you wanted something to bring a solution to it. Yeah. And so he traveled away from home. That was the last time I saw him. And somehow he had an attack away from home and he died. We weren't there. None of us were there, but he was with my aunt's family. And so we were told, you know, what we have is just what we were told, that he had had an attack. He was, I think, doing his laundry or so. And they took him to the hospital. He decided to talk to, you know, he started praying for those who were sick in the hospital. And he was more concerned about other people than himself. And he asked for one of his favorite meals, a local porridge from around here. And when they gave it to him after drinking, he decided to, you know, he called the names of all of us, his siblings, one by one, and prayed for us and said this was going to be the last for the family. And he passed away. And we have this terrible way of mourning that has not really helped us. You know, parents were not supposed to we're not expected to mourn for long for children. Your children are supposed to bury you, not you burying your children. So I think it was also terrible for my parents. They couldn't really mourn for him. He was young. You don't mourn. You know, it's like you don't even mourn for somebody who is young like that. So it was bad. And I think it caused a lot of complications for me. For years, I couldn't really talk about it. Somehow his name stopped being mentioned. And it was like I just took the grief and talked it somewhere. But over the years, I looked at it. For me, he was much better than I am. He was making impact. He was full of, you know, dreams, aspirations. How come he had to leave, you know? And here am I over the years. I couldn't really see much of the difference I was making. I think my pain was like hindering me from leaving, you know, being the person I really could be. But I had to, at the time, face it. You know, I had to look at it. I think I see him more like a shooting star. You know, shooting stars come. They don't stay long. They leave fast. They bring warmth and then they go. You know, I see him like that. But I had to face my life. I realized that if he was here, he wouldn't want me, you know, just living, just existing. And so you know, when he left, I was confused as a young girl. I needed his guidance. And I think because of what I lacked, I decided that I was going to start, you know, being there for younger people. So I started reaching out to girls. Around here, like I said, girls are somehow seen as second-class citizens. Boys are much more preferred. And so girls are supposed to be seen, not heard. Our voices, you know, were not to be heard. So many girls would not be leave out. There were jobs, there are roles that are not seen as, you know, for girls. There are things you really can't do as a girl. So I decided to be a mentor, a coach for girls. Presently, I mentor girls. I coach young girls, you know, how to navigate through life. I felt what I lost, I could give back. Of course, I had to work on myself. I had to learn, unlearn, and relearn, and, you know, self-develop. I had to build back my own confidence. I had to find my own voice. Of course, my elder brother was a great guy. We all have different lives. Some of us might not be, you know, that extraordinary, but I think the essence of life is just being who we are meant to be. Some might be loud, some might have loud voices, some our voices might be lower, but finding our own voice, telling our own stories, you know, accepting who we are, accepting our body types, accepting who God has made us, it helps. You know, you never can tell, like I said at the beginning, who is listening to your story, who is listening to you, who you might influence. We don't really know the you know, confusion somebody else might be going through. And so when we find ourselves, we become, you know, our authentic self. We uniquely can live the lives we are called to. We may not be loud like others. We may not be flashy. We may not do extraordinary things like others, but we can do only what we can do. No other person can do that. And so that has helped me. Presently, I'm working with girls. I am helping them, you know, stay on in school, encouraging girls to stay in school. We, you know, through my work, I run a nonprofit now. We've been able to keep girls in school. A lot of them are finding purpose. A lot of them are finding meaning to life. And, you know, they can live their lives and be all that God has created them to be. Yeah, I think majorly why I'm doing that is looking back at my brother's life. And he has taught me that he was just himself. I think that's what I realized. And I can just be myself too. Thank you.
What an amazing journey. And I would like to tell you that I think you are totally extraordinary. So I think the work you are doing is, of course, changing your community, but it is also part of changing the world, right? So as you said, you never know who's listening and you never know the girls who you are mentoring and coaching, who they will go on to impact and the children that they will go on to have and to bring up in the world. And I think when you look at the state of our world at the moment, there is so much trauma. There is so much inequality and unfairness that when I hear your story and your passion for others and your commitment to changing the future for all of these women and girls, I think you are absolutely as extraordinary as your brother. So thank you. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to ask you a little bit about the girls so that other people can understand. In the Western narrative, you know, we talk a lot in, you know, Europe and the USA about equality and, you know, women in the workplace and all of these types of things. Tell us a little bit about the reality today. You mentioned that girls are seen as less than boys and there's certain roles they're not allowed to do. Has that changed? Is it changing? And feel free to tell us geographically where you are so that we can have some context to how girls and women are living today in the part of the world you're in.
Okay, thank you. I live in the northeastern part of Nigeria. If you've heard of Boko Haram, you know, the Boko Haram insurgency.
Yes. Yes.
It's a place that's been ravaged by the insurgency. And even before this insurgency, the northern part of Nigeria, women are just, you know, meant to exist. They are seen more as commodities. And that's why we have early marriage. The girl doesn't really have a say. From her father's house, you know, her life is already planned. And she even gets married. She has to share a husband with, you know, three other women. And, you know, I think that's the kind of environment I'm from. But it's changing. Looking back now from when I was a little girl, things have changed. at least some of us can even, you know, the work I do many years ago, you don't hear women are not that vocal. But things are becoming different, you know, with education, with people talking about this thing, speaking against early marriage. You still have female genital mutilation. And so many other things, like girls cannot inherit. But like I said, it's changing. It's changing. And that's because people are speaking up. But unfortunately, I think in Nigeria, around this part of Nigeria, we still have, I think, one in every five girls are out of school or have never been in school and might never be in school if we don't work. And I see education as being the basic tool. You can't have any meaningful development anywhere without education, and especially education for women and girls. You know, educating a girl changes a whole lot. You're not just touching the girl's life, like you said earlier on. When a girl is educated, she knows her worth. She understands her right. She can speak up for herself and demand for her right. When a girl is educated, she understands her body and can take informed decisions about herself, about her future. When a girl is educated, she's not a liability to her family, because when she goes to school, she can earn for herself and so be financially independent. Most around here, you have women, you know, it's unfortunate. There are women who, from morning to evening, if the husband doesn't come home with food, you know, that's how they stay. Everything, they depend, everything. Even pads, like I did some of the work where there are girls we give reusable pads to. There are women, you know, unfortunately, if you don't give those girls and women those pads, it means for that month, they don't have what to use. And that's because they don't even have money to buy anything for themselves. So having a girl educated helps her gain financial freedom. And then, funny enough, you notice when women are financially blessed, they tend to give back to their families more. So their families are better off. They don't just touch their own lives. Their families are better off financially. And of course, a woman who is educated will want her own children to be educated. She will earn better. There are so many advantages to being educated. So I think that's the most basic tool for, you know, bringing this change. Because in school, she will understand so many of these things we're talking about. And then they now realize that there is nothing like gender roles. You can be anything you want to be as long as you want to be that. Yeah, so things are changing, though slowly. But to be honest, things 5-10 years ago, things are better today. So I think that's the kind of scenario which we're in. Sometimes we just celebrated the International Day for the Girl Child. That was in October, and we had some girls do spoken words, you know, and some of them were so uplifting. You realize that girls are discovering themselves. They are realizing that they can speak out. You know, they've been in this culture of silence where you talk at home or in the room and all of that. But girls are becoming, starting to discover other skills, the talents, potentials in them. And yeah, we're leveraging on that, using it to advocate for girls' education. So for me, education is basic. It should be encouraged. Girls should be in school. I'm encouraging girls to not just go to school, but to at least have a secondary school. That is what you call high school now. Yeah, to at least, because a girl who has at least a secondary school education would want to go further. She would want to earn. She wouldn't want her secondary school certificate to just lie there. And so she would want to work with it. So that's one of the things I'm advocating for, at least a secondary school education.
Again, thank you. You know, thank you for sharing and for the work you're doing. I want to ask you, where do you and the women you're working with get your inspiration from on a daily basis? And the reason I'm asking it, and of course your brother is a guiding light
for you.
But today, when I look at the world, there is so much war and terrorism and displacement of people. It can be hard to see that inspiration, right? So if you are a young woman living in a complex political environment, how do these women find their strength and their inspiration to study, to better themselves, given the context that they may be living in? What are your thoughts?
Okay, thank you. I think women are beginning to, they are seeing what other women can do. You know, when you have role models, you see what other women are capable of doing. Like presently, we have somebody like Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala from Nigeria too. She's a woman and she's doing great. Okay, in my one of my mentoring curriculum I have for girls in school, we have 30 stories of 30 women, 30 African women who have broken barriers, who are making impact. And so, you know, that's because of the power of having a role model. There is this thing. I remember when I go to some villages, you know, you see the girls light up when they hear you speak. Their faces, you know, it's like you're making them dream. And so I feel the place of having role models is very key. Many of these women are beginning to see, like when women speak out, when you have survivors, women speak out against sexual, gender-based violence. You know, you hear a woman who was able to do this, she took a step, she said no, and what it resulted. You know, other women are inspired. So there is this place of having models, women who are breaking barriers, women who are doing great things. That brings inspiration. Like one of the girls we just who just graduated now, she's the first girl in her family to complete a secondary school, you can imagine. And so when other girls see, like other girls within her family, they would say, oh, Deborah or Grace was able to, you know, take this step. Aisha was able to do this. And so I can too. So I think in this context of where we are, we have a lot of girls and women who are displaced, internally displaced. We have a lot of women who have lost a husband, a child, a relative from the terrorism, you know, the insurgency. But they've not given up hope, you know, taking that one step at a time, doing that one thing differently. Many of those women are just wanting to break, you know, the vicious cycle of the kind of backgrounds they've been brought. So women are daring. I see them, you know, daring to make a difference, taking just, you know, living one day at a time. Yeah.
Wow. So much. So much inspiration there. My last question I would like to ask a little bit. You've spoken a bit about Boko, you've spoken about the insurgency. One of the challenges I think we have as a world is that the media controls what we know, right? So currently, certainly in the Western media as we speak today, which is the 1st of November, 23, the Palestinian genocide is taking, you know, front page news, certainly on in this side of the world. Many people listening to this may have very little awareness of what Boko Haram, what insurgents, what displaced people means to you in Nigeria. Could you give us a little bit of the opportunity to understand the context? And then I want to close by talking a little bit more about your NGO and how we might help if people are keen to do so.
Okay. You know, some years back, the Boko Haram, they actually feel Western education is a taboo. They are against it. It's an Islamic group. And they feel, you know, it should be Islamic education that should take the center stage. So they are against everything. They feel education is a Western thing. And so it's against the faith. They attacked the burnt homes, they attacked government offices, government officials. So like I said, a lot of people lost one or two, three, four persons like that. They lost these properties and many people fled their homes. People can't go to the farms, because sometimes you're in the farm and, you know, they attack and all of that. Of course, when people are in fear, fleeing from war, you can't go to farm. And so largely around here, there is still that hunger thing. A lot of people lost their livelihood and so had to leave their homes. At the time, there were so many IDP camps, but presently some of the people are now being integrated back to their homes, but we still have a lot who are still displaced. They can't go back to their family homes again. They have made life, they're moving on. But not everybody has, you know, found their feet. Personally, I had to relocate too at a time. We lost our job, I and my husband. You know, I lost a business. But here we are back here again, you know, to help people who, you know, who are not as blessed as we are. And so, yes, we have, you remember the Chibok girls? Boko Haram were attacking girls in school too. Yeah, a lot of them are still under captivity. Unfortunately, the world is not talking about people like Leah Sharibu and the likes. We still have a number of girls who, especially the Christian girls who were forced to become Muslims, and they were converted under duress. Some of them were used as suicide bombers. You know, a girl could just be caught and she doesn't even know what she's carrying. She'd be sent into a largely populated place and then the bomb detonates and all of that. So that was the kind of environment in which we're in. Yeah. It's true, the mainstream media doesn't carry so much of what is happening, and then the narratives are changing. And, you know, at the time, the world was focusing on, you know, the northeastern part of Nigeria, but presently, things are still on. Like I said, some girls are still in captivity. They were in school, and they were captured. Yeah, we still need those girls back. We still want Leah Sharibu back, and all of that. So we are just trying to pick our lives and make the most of the situations in which we find ourselves. Girls, at the time, parents had this apathy against going to school because it was like they already had the problem of a girl is not supposed to be in school. She should be married off. You know, they feel she will be defiled if a girl is old, you know, getting to that puberty stage. Somehow she might disgrace the family by getting pregnant, and so it's easier to marry her. And then the few people who had their daughters in school, you know, got them captured. So the apathy increased. But we are sensitizing people. We are trying to get back people. And truly, some parents are listening. We even have some parents even paying. At the time, we were paying school fees for many girls just to encourage the parents. But some parents are listening now. And they are even paying their school fees. So it shows that there is this behavioral change. They are seeing what other women are doing, and they're knowing that a girl is equal to a boy too. As in, there is no difference. It's just what one makes of his life. That's what matters. So some parents are listening, but we still need the world to know that a lot of people who were displaced have not been able to find their feet back again. They need help. Schools need to be rebuilt. People should be a livelihood, you know, support for many parents. Yeah, I think this is just what I can remember for now.
Thank you. I mean, it's, as I said earlier, I think your work is, well, not just your work, the way you communicate and the way you're sharing with us today is truly inspiring. And it is such an act of tenacity, you know, the ability to find light where everything could otherwise be lost, and to really fight for change, as you said, for people that need you to fight on their behalf. I wish so much hope and patience and love on the work you're doing. Tell us a little bit about that work, and if there are listeners who want to support your work, tell us where we can find you.
Okay, thank you. I'm in Nigeria, in Yobe State, one of the states that was affected by the Boko Haram insurgency. And I run a nonprofit presently called Life Aid for Community Development Initiative. Our focus is women and girls because we think that they are more vulnerable than most in such situations as we find ourselves. And so what we do is to provide a leveled playing ground for girls and women to be able to realize their potential. There is so much that lies within every individual. And so every woman and girl, each one of them are endowed. We do our work to just help them realize that, give them the level playing ground that they can stand. And so one of the things we say is we give at least the least help to help women, you know, discover their potentials and be able to become change makers themselves. So we believe in having that rippling effect. A person whose life has truly been touched, a girl's life who has truly been touched, will somehow want to make positive change too. She would want to give back. And so that's what we are doing. Majorly, we're working with girls who also are living with disabilities. You know, they are even more vulnerable, further more vulnerable than just women because of their disabilities. We have a number of them who have been exposed to sexual gender-based violence because they live mainly by begging, and that exposes them to all manners of vices. So we take them in. For those of them who want to go to school, we send them to school, we help them get into school. And then those who feel like some of them 18, 19, it's difficult for those ones to start, you know, formal education. So what we do is we help them acquire skills. We presently have 12 girls that just graduated last week from their tailoring skill. The idea is, instead of them begging, let them get a skill so they can help themselves and then help their families. But we've not been able to. We planned giving them basic tools to start, you know, like starter kits. We've not been able to do that. We're hoping to do that. So if there are people who want to support us, do that. That would be welcome. And our major initiative right now is retaining girls in school. We do that to mostly keep girls from primary school up to secondary school. And through that, one of the reasons why girls are out of school around here is also menstrual poverty. So we distribute reusable pads to help them not miss school. Because if a girl menstruates every month, 3-4 days, it means for those 3-5 days, she's out of school. And her missing school will eventually lead to her dropping out of school. We don't want that. So these are some of the things we do just generally. But majorly, our work is to mainly...
Thank you for sharing. I will make sure that when this podcast goes live, we share all of the links to LifeAid, to the work you're doing, and that we spread the word as far and wide. I want to ask you, you never told me your brother's name. Can I ask his name?
Oh, his name is Deeko. Deeko.
What?
Deeko. D-I-K-K-O. It's a name given to the first male in a family. But he calls himself Big Sin. Yeah. He called himself Big Sin.
Well, I too am inspired by Dixon and everything he brought to you that has then brought it to me. So thank you for joining us today and sharing your story. The last question I always ask my guests is whether you want to share your name or whether you would like to remain anonymous.
Oh, I don't even know what to say. Okay.
There is no pressure. You can share your name or not. There are guests that do and guests that don't. So it's whatever you are comfortable with.
Okay, let me just share my name. I am Jephthita Mang.
Jephthita, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for the difference you are making in an incredibly complex world, which is unfair in so many ways, and for bringing your light to so many other women and girls. To everyone that was listening today, thank you for joining us for another episode of Mimi You You. I hope that you have been able to step into Northern Nigeria for the last 35 minutes or so and really understand how other people across the world are living their lives every day, different perhaps to your own. Thank you for being here, and I hope to see you next podcast. Thank you, Jephthita.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mimi You You. This episode is one in a series that has been designed to create empathy in our world. If you would like to join us on the show, please click on www.joinmimiuu.com or follow us across social media at MimiUU Show. I believe that the more the world talks about empathy, the more empathy the world will have. And I hope that this show is the beginning of doing just that.